Hello there. Today is Tuesday, November 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as Americans across the country prepare to vote in critical elections, celebrities, a former president, and the current U.S. leader make their final case.
The energy that we have, the energy that this whole party has now, it's really incredible.
What happens to the Russia investigation after the midterms? The U.S. reinstates all sanctions on Iran. Also ahead,
Amazing Grace.
46 years after it was shot, an Aretha Franklin concert film is set to be released. Sharply divided U.S. voters head to the polls Tuesday to elect a new Congress and to render a midterm judgment on President Donald Trump. The results of Tuesday's election could shift the balance of power in Washington and alter the next 2 years of Trump's presidency, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
For President Donald Trump, this year's midterm elections are personal.
All of this extraordinary progress is at stake. It is at stake. I'm not on the ballot, but in a certain way, I'm on the ballot, so please go out and vote. Go out and vote.
But as much as Trump motivates his core supporters, he also energizes critics like Jenny Hines.
There's an active resistance to this president who is operating as if he is above the law.
And does anybody have any questions?
Trump is the central figure in this year's election, says American University analyst David Barker.
Yes, Democrats from, you know, the day after the election in 2016 have been waiting for this day, and it's all about Trump. Trump fully embraces that. He wants it to be all about him.
Kanye's been a friend of mine for a long time.
Trump has accelerated a trend to nationalize congressional elections, says Laura Brown.
It really is now all national, and everyone is kind of looking at this as either a referendum for or against the president and his party.
For Trump and his base, it makes sense, says former Trump strategist Steve Bannon.
I think if you make this a national referendum and nationalize this election on the success of President Trump's program, it's a clear winner. And I think the Democrats get crushed.
But others are skeptical, including former Republican National Chairman Michael Steele.
All right, fine. You want it to be about you? Well, every candidate on the ballot now has to account for your behavior, has to account for your tweets.
Get out and vote. Thank you.
Trump is likely to generate higher Democratic turnout, says Maryland Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger.
When all you do is care about yourself and not about people, and not about people, what they need, not about your seniors needing medical care, and you just want to look good and knock them out, which is happening. This is hurting, and this is why I think a lot of people will come out.
We are going to fight, and we are going to win, win, win.
But the president does not seem to be worried, preferring instead to rally his own supporters, says Gallup pollster Frank Newport.
He's kind of given up on attempting to broaden his appeal, it looks like. It fits more with his style. He has a very, as we all know, a very combative style. He likes to have enemies because that gives him somebody to fight against. So it would be hard for a president like Trump anyhow to probably try to broaden his appeal.
Donald Trump's name will not appear on the November 6th election ballots, but the results could determine the future of his presidency. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, ahead of the midterms, civil rights and other voting advocacy groups have been sounding an alarm over suspected voter suppression in a number of states. It's a claim that is often made ahead of U.S. elections, but appears to be more widespread this time. In most cases, it's affecting voters of color, who are generally considered more likely to vote for Democrats. But there has also been a big push to get out the vote from both political parties. Here's President Trump at a rally on Sunday.
Whoever even heard of midterm? They don't even know what it is. I've had a lot of people say, I don't know what midterm is, but now I'm watching every single minute and I'm going out to vote. But the key is you have to go out to vote.
When former President Barack Obama, who's been campaigning for Democrats, had a message as well.
What we have not seen before, at least not in my lifetime, are politicians who are blatantly, repeatedly, baldly, shamelessly lying. Don't boo, vote.
Don't boo, vote, he says. And while it appears that there will be a larger than normal turnout in a few other Democratic, a larger than normal turnout in a few other Democratic countries, it isn't even an issue. Joining us now is Zoe Robinson, professor of political science with Australian National University. You have a unique perspective because you're a dual American and Australian citizen, but I understand in Australia voting isn't a right, it's a duty. So turnout isn't even an issue. Voting isn't something people have to be convinced to do, right?
Compulsory voting was adopted for voting at federal elections in 1912. It was 11 years after our independence from Great Britain. And all states now have compulsory voting. And everybody has to vote or you get fined.
So it's just a mandatory thing. Everyone votes. And is it just something that people just plan to do?
Yeah. Voting for us is on Saturdays. It's not on a weekday. So it's set up to ensure that everybody can attend and ballot. There are large numbers of election places, places of voting, polling places. They're usually held at schools or town halls. There are enough that there's not usually a significant line. I don't think I've ever waited more than half an hour to vote in Australia. I waited 4 hours in Chicago. So... and it's open when there's sausage sizzles on and there you get a barbecue that's running outside all day and you get fed food and breakfast. They call them the election sausage here. You go along, you get your election sausage, you vote and you go home and everybody votes. It's just part of what we do and it's part of the culture.
Fascinating. So there's never really any question about whether or not of candidates going out there and pushing people to go to the polls because that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about the issues and their
Correct.
View. Is it like that anywhere else in the world?
There is compulsory voting, as far as I'm aware, in a handful of countries. Belgium, I know, has the oldest existing compulsory voting system. Just quickly looking at my notes, compulsory voting was introduced in 1893 for men in Belgium, and then women, when universal suffrage came in, I think in the 1940s. So Australia also has compulsory voting, and I believe there are a handful of other jurisdictions that have it, but it is not the norm. You're right, it is not the norm. But the idea is that it gives a heightened political legitimacy. Right? We have a turnout in the 90%, 90 to 100% of eligible voters turn out. And the Independent Electoral Commission does a lot of work, for example, for rural voters and Indigenous voters. So I was asking a colleague earlier, I said, what about in remote Indigenous communities? Is that kind of a form of voter suppression in that they're not registered to vote? She said, no, the Electoral Commission, this Independent Electoral Commission, actually does a lot of work in going out and helping the Indigenous communities vote and then collecting their votes and actually having them count.
Overall, how would you say it, given that you have dual citizenship and you've mm-hmm. been here in the U.S. and in Australia, how would you say that the compulsory voting works out?
I think that compulsory voting is important, and I say that as an Australian. I think that it's very different from a U.S. perspective. Even my colleagues, my constitutional law colleagues, think that it's insane to have compulsory voting. Because they think it's a right. They see voting as a right rather than a duty. And I think it's different in Australia. We see it as a duty, as a civic duty, and it compares to things like taxation and education and jury duty. We don't see it as a liberty or a liberty right. We see it as something that we do as a participant and part of a political community. And I think there is something to be said for that, taking responsibility for your institutions and your institutional actors and your political actors. I think it's really important to do that. Otherwise, you may avoid ending up in situations like we have in the US today. With that said, Australia hasn't avoided controversy. You know, we've elected some people, some prime ministers who have been fairly controversial in kind of right-wing ways that the US has. But because of this compulsory voting system, when the next election comes around 3 years later or sooner, then the whole community takes responsibility and then deals with that as the community sees fit.
All right, that is Zoe Robinson, professor of political science with Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. 80 students and a principal kidnapped in Cameroon. Iraqi refugees in Syria refuse to return home. The Tanzanian government is distancing itself from calls for LGBTQ crackdown. And Cameroon detains journalists reporting on unrest for propagating false information. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. After the midterm elections, Americans will be watching to see what happens next with the special counsel's Russia investigation and what President Trump might do about the Justice Department officials who are overseeing it. Special counsel Robert Mueller is under intense pressure to announce his findings or end the probe. If the president fires those in charge of the investigation, the people who replace them could be forced to fire Mueller or end the investigation. Joining us now to talk about what might happen is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, it's been very quiet with little information coming out leading up to the midterms. What do you think we will be seeing and hearing?
There really is an unwritten Justice Department policy on this. The purpose is to make sure that you don't have a political impact. Of course, that sort of ignores what happened with FBI Director James Comey in the last election, but nevertheless, I think that is the goal. But if you look at where they are right now, there's a couple of things that I think the Mueller investigation is really looking at. And that has to do with former Trump advisor Roger Stone and his potential contacts with WikiLeaks and maybe even his conspiracy and involvement there. That's a very, very big issue, and I think one that the investigation is really looking at. I think there's a couple of others, though, that I think are as important potentially. There's still issues of statements that were made by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr. These are all issues that are out there. And then, of course, the last one, and maybe the biggest, is that the investigation has wanted to sit down with the president himself. His lawyers have pushed back, but in the end, that's really what they want.
We haven't heard a word about that, whether the president actually agreed or didn't agree, or if he's been subpoenaed. Is it possible that he has been subpoenaed and we don't know about it?
No, I don't think that would have happened yet. Typically, the way it would work is you're pushing back and forth because there's a lot of legal questions on whether or not technically, if he were subpoenaed, he could be forced to sit down. And generally, you use that subpoena as something that's sort of the driving force at the end of the day. You wouldn't do it on the front end. They're still trying to negotiate about it. The Trump administration has really tried to either answer no questions or answer all of them in writing. The problem with in writing questions, of course, is that it's likely that the president will never answer any of those, and those are all done in very legalese, and it's done to essentially say nothing and protect the president completely rather than actually have him be honest and forthcoming. Also, on the other hand, we know that the investigation itself, they really want to sit down with the president because they want to know what it is that he actually has to say. And we know that this president shoots from the hip.
Really, we haven't seen an indication that Mueller's ready to close this down. This is only coming from reports that he's sort of being pressured to do that. Of course, we know the president's been calling this whole thing a witch hunt. And we're also hearing that after the midterms, the president could be potentially firing the people that oversee the investigation in the Justice Department. What would that mean for if he fires Attorney General Jeff Sessions and, of course, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who is overseeing the case?
That's actually a really big deal. The potential of the president firing a whole slew of people could potentially have an impact on the process itself, especially Rod Rosenstein, because he really is overseeing the investigation. In fact, Bob Mueller has to go to Rosenstein. If he is fired, he would be replaced by the Solicitor General, strangely enough. The Solicitor General actually has conflicts of his own when it comes to this issue as well. So there's a lot of questions on what that might potentially mean. The idea that he could shut the investigation down himself, whether or not something like that could happen. Now, there are limitations there because I think that would drive the investigation to produce some results. And I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing sort of expansive indictments. So in other words, what I mean is that the indictments actually have more information in them than is necessary in order to prove a charge. The benefit of something like that is it lays out more of what the investigation is doing and why it's important, not just for the charge itself, but for future parts of the investigation to make it actually harder to shut the investigation itself down.
So do you think it's possible that even if Rod Rosenstein got fired, that this investigation would continue? Or for that matter, if Mueller was fired, would his work continue? Do you think he's put it in a safe place so it can't be sort of hidden? Or I don't know how that works.
Well, I think that he is not going to be fired. In a case like this, what you have is a very, very serious and intense investigation where these people are moving forward and they're establishing every claim that they make. And what they will do as fast as they have to is they will make that as public as they possibly can. In the end, there are laws in place that require that once you provide that to whoever is in charge, meaning Rosenstein or whoever would come next, there is a requirement to disclose that even if you were to shut it down. So in other words, you would have to say, well, I'm looking at this, here it is, but I'm still going to shut it down. The problem with that, of course, is if you do that, that still puts that in the hands of members of Congress. Now, there have been limitations there, of course, because the Republicans have been in charge in both the House and the Senate on the Intelligence Committees and the Judiciary Committee. But if you see some election changes, you may have a more interesting look at that issue, especially on the House intelligence side.
Do you think there's still a possibility the president will be subpoenaed?
Yes, I do. I think that if you look at the number of people who have actually been indicted, but the one thing we have seen is an incredibly thorough investigation with some very, very sharp people. And I think they know that the world is watching. So if you look at the investigation itself, they are literally looking at every angle of this to ensure that if they say something, it's something that they can prove. It's something that they can establish and is beyond reproach. Ultimately, that is their goal.
All right. That's criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. The Trump administration has reimposed sanctions on Iran's oil industry and financial sector, following through on pledges to roll back relief Iran received as part of the international agreement to limit its nuclear program. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said Monday the sanctions restore bans on purchasing Iranian oil, a major component of Iran's economy. VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain tells International Edition's Sarah Williams that U.S. officials believe it's now up to Iran to determine its future.
Secretary Pompeo said that the Iranian regime, as he said, can either do a 180-degree turn from what he called its outlaw course of action and act like a normal country, or it can see its economy crumble. And Treasury Secretary Mnuchin made clear just the scope of these sanctions, saying that Monday, 700 individuals, entities, aircrafts, and vessels were targeted in the U.S. Treasury's largest ever single-day action. So this was a very, very comprehensive move today.
However, there are countries that are receiving waivers, including Turkey, China, India, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Italy, and Greece. Apparently, they represent the majority of Iran's oil exports. So in a way, these sanctions seem like they're somewhat restrained.
That's right, Sarah. And some critics are saying, you know, that the administration has not been tough enough in allowing the sanctions. And as the secretary announced, those countries, who are basically some of Iran's biggest importers of Iranian oil, he said, indicated that the U.S. also did not want to destabilize the international oil market. So that may have been a consideration. You know, there's always political considerations, domestic political considerations with these measures as well. And I think the U.S. does not want to see, you know, domestic gasoline prices skyrocketing,
particularly with the midterms coming up.
Yes, right.
What has been the Iranian reaction to this?
Well, so far, Iranian leaders have been defiant, saying that they will continue to sell oil and that they will be proud to defy these sanctions, and saying that it is the U.S., which is, in fact, isolated in the international community. So we'll have to see. You know, there's been some interesting indications on both sides saying, well, you know, we would like to talk. Secretary Pompeo has said that the president would be willing to talk, but Iran would need to ask. And so we'll see whether these sanctions will perhaps lead to some kind of new talks and some kind of new deal with Iran in the future.
Iran has denied that its nuclear program is designed at producing nuclear weapons, saying it isn't complying with the 2015 agreement. So I guess there's a lot of dispute as to whether Iran is in compliance or not.
Well, that's right. And some even a lot of experts here in the U.S. have said that Iran was, in fact, in compliance with the Iran, the so-called Iran nuclear deal. And President Trump pulling out of the deal in May, this administration, the Trump administration, has always stressed that Iran is a bad actor, they say, in a lot of other ways. And they were asked, Secretary Pompeo was asked, you know, why are you sanctioning Iran and not Saudi Arabia? You know, we've just seen recently the brutal murder of a journalist in a Saudi consulate in Turkey. And Secretary Pompeo said that there's a remarkable difference between the two and that Saudi Arabia has helped the U.S. in counterterrorism efforts, whereas he said that Iran is the single most destabilizing factor in the Middle East today.
VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain, you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. The Freddie Mercury biopic Bohemian Rhapsody shrugged off production troubles and mediocre reviews to debut well above expectations. The 20th Century Fox release was number one at the box office for its opening weekend in the U.S. Joining us now for a review of this and one other movie that's getting a lot of buzz, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, tell us about Bohemian Rhapsody.
This is a biopic of the band Queen and the incredible, flamboyant, talented, legendary lead singer Freddie Mercury.
I want to give the audience a song that they can perform.
What's the lyric?
Sing it.
So as a Queen fan, I mean, this is like one of the first rock bands when I was a little boy that I outside of Disney songs and fairy tales, you know, nursery rhymes, this and the Beatles were the two bands that I was first introduced to. And so when I heard they were doing this biopic, I was intrigued because Queen is not only just one of the most popular bands of all time, but also the most beloved worldwide, especially in England, right? So when they started this biopic, I was so excited because I want to know, as these biopics unfold, how they met, how certain songs came to be. We Will Rock You, Another One Bites the Dust, Bohemian Rhapsody, all of those. So I thought, what a complicated task. Who are you going to find to play Freddie Mercury? And they found Rami Malek, you know, from Mr. Robot. You know, when you find an actor that finds a role of a lifetime that's going to define him, this is it. Not only does he look like Freddie Mercury, act like Freddie Mercury, but you think he's just channeling Freddie Mercury. And overall, the movie does explore more of Freddie Mercury's life in the band, and he is the band, think about it.
Right.
But it really dealt with his drug abuse, his flamboyant lifestyle, his illness when he had AIDS, one of the first early cases of AIDS, also the breakup with the band, and what fame and fortune does to a person when they're on that rapid ride.
Right.
We do find out like how they do certain songs and how the band came up with certain things, like We Will Rock You, we want an anthem that the audience can play with us, you know. But overall, it's worth it just for the last 15 minutes when they did that live AIDS concert at Wembley Stadium, considered probably one of the greatest rock performances of all time. The last 15 minutes is actually recreated shot for shot with the actual audio from that with the band and the actors performing it. So it's really an amazing film. If you're a Queen fan, you're going to really go crazy for it, even though there are parts that are pretty slow, but it's worth it just to see Freddie Mercury being portrayed by Rami Malek in that last 15 minutes. So I really was excited about the movie, and it's a big winner.
What about the music? Is it for the movie, do they use the original music?
You know, that's a good question. It sure sounds like the original music, you know. I don't know about any other Freddie Mercury sound-alikes, but I never could seem to find out if that was really them singing or the original soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
The original band, you know, the surviving members were consultants. It's their movie.
Hmm.
So I'm sure they took great care to either using original recordings or making sure that they were satisfied with how the movie's going to be represented. Overall, the music, just you come out humming all these songs for the time. I saw it a couple weeks ago, and every time someone asked me about the movie, I got a couple songs stuck in my head.
Oh, wow. Cool. Well, we've got also another movie that just came out, Beautiful Boy, another addiction type of movie, obviously not a musical one, but this one about a father and son. Tell us more about Beautiful Boy.
Right. This is from author David Sheff, who wrote a memoir about his journey with his son's addiction, his teenage son. In the movie, it's Steve Carell, who's best known for his comedic roles, you know, The Office and Anchorman and those kind of films. But he started out as a dramatic actor. He just achieved comedic roles that, you know, 40-year-old virgin and all of these films put him to superstardom. But he started out as a dramatic actor. He wasn't a comedian. He plays the father who's dealing with his teenage son, played by Timothy Chalamet, who's the darling of the independent film world right now, how last year was Call Me By Your Name and nominated for the Academy Award. And he's going through not just one drug, but multiple drugs.
When I tried it, I felt better than I ever had, so I just kept on doing it.
And if anyone has gone through somebody in their family or friend that's gone through addiction, who's lost a loved one or a friend to addiction, this movie really hits home. You know, I can say that for myself. I've known people through in rehab 3 or 4 times, people who have died before. Opioid epidemic, heroin epidemic, it's out there. And this movie doesn't pull any punches. And when you're watching this and keeping in mind that it's a true story, it's even more heartbreaking. You're going to hear a lot of buzz on this from awards season. And it's just really a powerful film. It's one of my favorite films of the year. And it's something that everyone should see and everyone can relate to. And it should start dialogues, too, with
people. Many, many people have either dealt with addiction or know someone who has been addicted, and often what comes with that, survival, relapse.
Right, and this is one father's story. And as you watch it, you know, you say to yourself, if you've been in those shoes, you try to help someone over and over and over again, so you finally, you know, realize, look, you can't help them, and they want to help themselves.
Right.
So the movie is not pretty. The movie is, like I said, very honest, and two of the best performances I've seen all year. Don't miss it. It's an incredible film.
That's Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com.
All right.
More than 46 years after it was shot, the Aretha Franklin concert film Amazing Grace will finally be released, ending one of the most tortured and long-running sagas in documentary films. The late gospel singer's estate and film's producers said Monday that Amazing Grace will premiere November 12th at the DOC NYC Film Festival with the full support of Franklin's estate. The film captures Franklin's performance at the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in the Los Angeles Watts neighborhood in January of 1972. The music from the two performances was released as a landmark double live album in 1972. And after acquiring the film's rights in 2007, producer Alan Elliott brought in a team to construct the film, which he calls a labor of love. Franklin passed away in August. The late singer's estate said Amazing Grace was an important part of her legacy. Franklin's niece, Sabrina Owen, said Monday that the film is authentic and her aunt, at her core, a daughter of the church who loved gospel music and always incorporated some sort of sacred music in her concerts. An Oscar qualifying release is planned for this fall, with a larger rollout in theaters likely coming next year. The film doesn't yet have distribution. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Amazing Grace. Woo!